Rather than my usual introduction, I've been asked to pass along this message from two black holes colliding with each other, roughly 1 billion light years from where I'm standing. I've also been provided with the following translation. Greetings. We are black holes. We just did a chest bump in space. The result was as if someone took the space-time continuum and shook it like a bedsheet. So the time speeded up in some places and slowed down in other places. Wait, there's more to the message. Nothing in your world will ever be the same again. You are not aware of it, but shoes and burritos have totally changed places. You are wearing two burritos on your feet. You will eat a shoe in the near future. We can do much worse things, but we will leave you alone if you agree to... Wait a second. To load Rudy Giuliani into a space capsule and shoot him out to the edge of your solar system. We will take him and spank him really hard for 10 million years. He'll probably kind of like it for the first day or so. That is all. Okay, then. Some of you strong types, go grab Rudy. I'll have Patrick and McPants gas up the space Tesla. The rest of you, listen to the notes. And now, the leader of hashtag stop picking on Chris Martin, Colin McEnroe.
It's very disturbing the way space and time are speeding up and slowing down. Fortunately for everybody, probably, we're not going to be discussing the chirp from outer space today. We have other things to talk about on the nose. And we're going to begin with, first of all, the artistic statement that is Formation, the new video and single released by Beyoncé, and then the controversy that goes along with it. It's kind of a made-up controversy, probably, but we'll talk about that. A little bit later, we'll be talking about the debut of the latest late-night comedy show. That's Samantha Bee, an alumna of The Daily Show, of course. And then towards the end, we'll talk about our divided consciousness when we absorb things like, say, a political debate while using Twitter at the same time. All of that, plus some recommendations. So let me tell you who's here. Starting over here on the left, Teresa Kramer is the founder and leader of The Cut, a magazine for grumpy young adults in Connecticut. And sitting next to her is Irene Papoulis, a professor at Trinity College. Next to her is the writer and critic Rann Richards Cooper. And then making her debut on the nose from upstairs at the Journalism and Media Academy is Madison Frame, who's going to help us with some of the sort of semiotics of the formation video by Beyoncé. So just to set this up a little bit, the day before the Super Bowl, Beyoncé did release Formation. It's her first new song since 2014. It appeared on Tidal and on YouTube in advance of her Sunday appearance at the Super Bowl halftime show. The song's subjects are multiple. It's ranging from Beyoncé's own self-affirmation to all kinds of commentary about police brutality, Hurricane Katrina, black financial power, sexuality, you name it. Let's hear just a little bit of Formation.
Y'all haters corny with that Illuminati mess. Paparazzi, catch my fly and my cocky fresh. I'm so reckless when I rock my Givenchy dress. I'm so possessive, so I rock his rock necklaces. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama.
All right. Nothing about the song really can be absorbed fully without seeing the video. I mean, increasingly in culture these days, the song is the video. The video is the song. I think that's especially true with this one. I mean, the video is this kind of symposium on all kinds of issues arising in the Deep South. So, Madison, maybe you can get us started here. I mean, as you look at that video, she's saying a lot of things at once, isn't she? Anything really jump out at you in particular?
Not necessarily what she's saying, but the beginning shot to the video is her sitting on a police car that's submerged in water.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some people were saying, like, oh, why is she slandering the law enforcement? And nobody helped the evacuees in Katrina when they were in trouble.
Right. It also appears that she's in you know, in New Orleans, right? In that shot, like, you can see the, you know, submerged homes behind her.
Yeah, the rising waters around her. Yeah, so there's that. There's, I mean, probably everybody saw a little something a little bit different. And we'll come back to this controversy, too, what's being claimed about this video, which I'm not sure is entirely backed up by what we all saw in the video. Although that's one of your points, Irene, right? When you look at something like this, and this is an incredibly dense montage, it throws a lot of information, a lot of perception at you. And so we can only look at it through the filters that we have, or at least we tend to kind of map our own perceptions against whatever map we're using to get through life.
Well, yeah, I'd say not only the filters we already have. I mean, I watched the halftime show. You know, I wasn't watching the game, but I was like, okay, let me just see. I saw Beyoncé do that. I was thinking, okay, Michael Jackson, yeah, okay, looks good, fine. She's with a lot of women. That's it. And then I started to, you know, read certain things. And so I think that we also form our perception really quickly these days by the people that we trust and what they're saying about it. So, you know, the people. So then I started to think, wow, really? Okay, so there's an X, homage to Malcolm X. I started to hear that. And then little by little, the layers started to pile on because of the sources, you know, online sources probably, maybe just a little thing on Facebook or people saying certain things that I started to see more.
And so, Rand, one of the things that this video assumes, it was on a different show about culture, one of the panelists said it kind of presumes this army of semioticians getting ready to sort of take something like this and really look at it. I mean, this isn't really entirely new. I mean, the Beatles would, 30, 40 years ago, drop something that was pretty complicated, had a lot of allusions and references. But this really does presume that people are going to take this video and watch it 10 or 12 times and kind of mine it. I mean, stuff goes by very fast, and it's all kind of important. So what did you mine from it?
Well, you know, one thing to say is that there are different ways of watching this, not just depending on what your own framework is. But when I was watching the Super Bowl, I thought it was a great halftime show. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I wasn't able to hear the lyrics. It was loud. There was a lot of ambient noise. But the overall production of the Super Bowl halftime show was so mind-blowingly cool. So logistically amazing in terms of the limited space and time, to use the Einsteinian terms, that they have to get this show done. And I thought Beyoncé was terrific. I love Coldplay. I thought they were lame. I think that their music is so ill-suited to the Super Bowl format that I was just glad to have Beyoncé and Bruno Mars there to supply formations, by which I mean dances, and sort of help get Coldplay through it. Now, so I thought after that controversy sprang, I thought, come on, it's a Super Bowl halftime show. Now, the issue of politics in the Super Bowl was a great one. I think we'll handle that afterward. What I noticed when I then pay attention to the video formation is both the various formations of people who, among other things, are dancing in the video, but obviously it's personal formation. This is autobiography. The big American question, who am I? Where do I come from? That's a question that all Americans ask themselves in some ways. And personal history is a fascinating interbreeding of all sorts of things. So this is partly Beyoncé's story. I'm Alabama, but I'm Louisiana. It's also a story of coming to terms with success, what success does to you as an American. It takes you in some ways away from your roots. It puts you in a particular responsibility to where you came from. There are juxtapositions of images of glamour and wealth and also urban poverty in this. So I noticed that too. And finally, the last thing I would say is there are – and she says, I may be a black Bill Gates in the making. There are ways in which – images of specific roles long sort of not open to African Americans, whether it's cowboys or people wearing Givenchy or the Southern Tea Party. And there's a co-optation or occupation of these things, including, hey, a billionaire millionaire, a billionaire genius, excuse me. And so there's a way of claiming American roles that's part of the formation she's insisting on.
So, Madison, I mean, it seems to me that there's sort of two things, at least two modes of address going on in this video. On the one hand, she's talking to you, really. She says, and I think it's kind of a pun, too. She says, ladies, let's get information. Well, that could be information. formation or information. And I think she means it both ways. She's saying, know what you need to know in order to succeed the way that I've succeeded. But it seems to me another thing that she's saying, and tell me how you feel about both of these, is she's also saying, I may be this incredibly rich international icon, but I have these roots and I am not, I want to remind you of who I am and where I come from, and also let you know that I haven't forgotten that. I don't think I've outgrown what my origins are. Those are the two messages I'm hearing.
Personally, what I got from actually reading the lyrics, mm-hmm. Was that the last line in the song, she says, always stay gracious, best revenge is your paper. And I know by paper she means money. Mm-hmm. And people were slandering her for like saying or putting this black stereotype and going against it and everything. But what I got from it was that stop hating people because they're black or because of their skin color, and realize if you are black and you are being oppressed, that the only way to get back to have revenge or to get or to come back is to get money or to be wealthy like those who are oppressing you.
Well, you know, I wondered about that. The best revenge is your paper. So, yeah, and she kind of rubs her fingers together in the video a little bit like she's talking about money. But and I'm stealing this observation, I think, from the critic Wesley Morris, but I can't remember. Maybe it's somebody else. I think it was Wesley Morris who said, you know, it might be too reductive to say that's just about money. That really what she's – because, in fact, if you look at the video is also sort of about property, who has property, who doesn't – who's legitimate, who's not. One thing that I learned about – and we're doing all the reading about this video. I mean, this video is like you could just teach an entire semester course in this video. So I learned about plaisage, which, you know, were these sort of women who were almost halfway between legitimate partners of white men and concubines. It was sort of somewhere between that there. And some of the outfits that Beyoncé wears evoke that.
And they were sexualized by white men as though they had like a different kind of sexuality from other women, and that it was much more, you know, intense and driven and all that. And those are the racist stereotypes that were put on those women.
So might not paper also mean all other kinds of legitimacy? I mean, your legitimacy is what kind of paper you've got, you know, where are your papers, right? Do you own property? Where's your birth certificate? Where's your, you know, who are mm-hmm. you? I wonder if it might be more than money that's being talked about there.
Or just success. Yeah. You know? I mean, I was thinking about, you know, what about it? What about Beyoncé has the right so riled up at this point? And, I mean, who is more powerful in pop culture than Beyoncé right now? Pretty much no one. I mean, Coldplay has to feel pretty bad about itself right now because I haven't even seen that part of the show, to be honest with you. Because Beyoncé was there. No one cares about Coldplay, right? And, I mean, Beyoncé is the epitome of pop culture power at this point. But also, Jay-Z, her husband, is, you know, a mogul at this point. And the two of them are the power couple. So and at one point, Beyoncé was very sort of when she was in Destiny's Child, it was, you know, a lot of, hey, ladies, like just very friendly pop music. And now she's taking a political stand and people are like, oh, God, somebody's going to listen to her, you know.
Let's take a quick break so we can come back and look at the political side of this and what some of the reactions have been. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back after this. I might get your phone played on the radio station. You just might be a black Bill Gates in the making. I just might be a black Bill Gates in the making. I want it. All right, we're back with the news. We should do a shout out to Rich Holland. It's the guy who kind of got us on this track of talking about formation. We might have figured it out anyway, but anyway, Rich couldn't be with us today, so kind of sitting in for him is Madison Frame, a junior, a high school junior, upstairs at the Journalism and Media Academy, very bravely sitting in here with all these jackals from the news.
I know. I can't believe you agreed to this.
Teresa Kramer, Irene Vabulis, and Rand Richards Cooper also with us. So let's get to the controversy. All right, so I was sort of like Rand. I hadn't really gone to school on the video in the previous 24 hours, watched the halftime show and just was freaking out with just particularly the little kind of dance-off between Bruno Mars and Beyoncé and the mashup. They take the two songs and kind of mash them together. And I was thinking, this is great. It never occurred to me that there was any politics at all to this. Mm-hmm. Turned out, well, there were. Here's Rudy Giuliani talking on Fox News. Where else?
And I thought it was really outrageous that that she used it as a platform to attack police officers, who are the people who protect her and protect us and keep us alive. And what we should be doing in the African-American community, in all communities, is build up respect for police officers and focus on the fact that when something does go wrong, okay, we'll work on that. But the vast majority of police officers risk their lives to keep us safe. And this is her political position. She's probably going to take advantage of it. You're talking to middle America when you have the Super Bowl. So if you can have entertainment, let's have, you know, decent, wholesome entertainment and not use it as a platform to attack the people who, you know, put their lives at risk to save us.
Madison, during the break, you were talking about how people react to certain kinds of art.
Yeah, the moment art tells the truth, certain people begin to react and like, oh my gosh, they can't find this out. They're telling the truth. They can't find this out.
It's the Super Bowl. You're not supposed to tell us anything. You're not supposed to say anything important to us. And I also, okay, so first of all, the Super Bowl performance simply didn't have that kind of content to it. You'd have to, I mean, some intern had to have grabbed Rudy Giuliani and said, watch this video. There's all kinds of other stuff going on here.
Stuff in the Super Bowl.
No, whatsoever. So,
I mean, his real thing, what he's saying is that her backup dancers are dressed like Black Panthers, apparently, which just means they had berets on and were wearing the color black.
Right. There isn't really a Black Panther uniform, so.
Yeah. And as a podcast I was listening to Angela Davis would never wear that. Like, right. You know, but.
Well, there were Black Panthers there. They played for Carolina. Well, maybe that's what confused him. But yeah, I also just want to talk about the police message here in this video. And so one of the most arresting, pardon the pun, moments it comes to the end of the video. There's this tiny child in a hoodie who's kind of dancing freestyle in front of this impassive line of policemen. But then he puts his hands up. They put their hands up, right? And then there is this, you see a graffito that says, stop shooting us. But Irene, I don't know. There's a lot of ways you could read that moment.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it's funny that the only thing Giuliani could identify with in the video was the white men who were the police, you know. So, but
can you even see their faces?
You couldn't really see their faces. But I think he's also picking up on something that is really there in the video, because it's really saying, you know, we have a serious problem in our country, and we want to and we have to empower African Americans in this country. We have to stop police brutality. We have to stand up to it. There are ways for people to get information to really fight the powers that are there. And so that, I think that is a very powerful message, and you know, one that I agree with and I think is wonderful. And I think it really is a threat to a certain kind of system that really Rudy Giuliani represents.
Yeah, to me, I don't know. I mean, Rand, I feel as though Rudy Giuliani and then other contingents, other members of the Fox contingent, they're kind of in the business of getting riled up about this stuff, whether or not there's a lot there to get riled up about. If they can't do that, you know, if Rush Limbaugh can't have a supremely negative reaction to something a performer like Beyonce does in the Super Bowl, he's got no material on Monday morning.
Well, I think one thing that's going on is a tug of war about what the meaning of the Super Bowl is going to be. Now, it seems a little silly on the face of it that a football game should even have a meaning. If you go back 50 years ago to the first Super Bowl, it wasn't called the Super Bowl. It was just a championship game between two leagues that nobody much cared about. There were 30,000 empty seats. The tickets were $12, and they had a brief few songs by Up With People at halftime. So in the 50 years since then, the game has been built up into this enormous extravaganza, and people want to lay claim to it, A, to make enormous amounts of money, but also to try to put a handle on what its meaning is going to be. And what is a very militarized game, a game that I love, but it's fair to say in a whole bunch of ways, it's a militarized game, has been used as a sort of exportable emblem of a certain kind of American patriotism that is not reflective about American character, that is quite military. We have military flyovers. where the use of the American flag is very conspicuous. So for someone like Rudy Giuliani to say, oh, we don't want this to be, you know, politicized, is either disingenuous or you know, pretty stupid. The game is in many ways a political artifact. Now, I would argue that Beyoncé's contribution could be seen as a really interesting way to recalibrate or reconfigure the notion of what patriotism is. The story she shows in that video is a very American story. It's an African-American story, but it's a story of all sorts of traditions coming together, and it's a politically conscious story. Now, there have been all sorts of other politically conscious halftime U2, Bono, Springsteen. These are people whose music is often very political, but they don't get taken to task for being political. They somehow fit. So you have to be a little skeptical when someone is saying, oh, this doesn't fit. This is a misuse of the Super Bowl. I think that's all way wrong. Mm-hmm. You have to see it for what it is.
Madison, what were you going to say about that?
I mean, it's not even just being at the Super Bowl. Even like if she hadn't done at the Super Bowl, if the video had just come out itself, people would have there would have been backlash. Mm-hmm. But the moment Kendrick Lamar's song All Right comes out, I forgot where he was performing it, but he was jumping on a police car at the performance. And he got backlash for it a little bit, mm-hmm. but not as much as Beyonce's video is getting back. And I think that song's far more angry and far more about police than Beyonce's formation.
Yeah, because
is.
If you take the song for what it is, take the context of the video away from the song, it has absolutely nothing to do with police. It's really about self-esteem, basically, exactly. This entire
yeah.
this song.
Right, right.
So it's the context of the video that adds any of that, and that was stripped away from the Super Bowl unless you think these women were dressed like Black Panthers, and that's still not the same thing.
Giuliani's acting as if this is Tommy Smith and John Carlos in 1968 at Mexico City. Yeah. It's absolutely not that. The gesture that they made in raising black gloved fists in solidarity and in protest was, among other things, a career-wrecking move for those guys. Hmm. When you are launching your critique of America from a platform that is then immediately convertible into like multi-bazillion dollar tours and CDs and so on, it's also interestingly different. And she also takes that on in the video. There are layers to this that, you know, don't end.
Let me grab a quick call from Amy in New Haven here. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Colin.
You're on the air.
I just wanted to present sort of a different interpretation of the notion of formation, because I really see it sort of as her call for unity within the community. I liked your interpretation of information as well. Mm-hmm. But I think this idea of paper at the end is not just making millions of dollars, but it's where you spend your money. And I think she's calling for people to start doing that in a more conscious way.
Hmm. Really, once again, sort of proof that this can be looked at a whole bunch of different ways. I mean, another thing that was going on here, I mean, I made a little joke about Black Panthers, Carolina Panthers, but I mean, in reality, what ran up to the Super Bowl was the storyline going into the Super Bowl really had to do with this old school white quarterback, Peyton Manning, up against this young black quarterback, Cam Newton, who was drawing a lot of criticism, too, for being too flamboyant, for being too talkative, for dancing too much after touchdowns. So in a way, the crossbow was already loaded to have this conversation. And I do think that somehow there's a way in which formation – I'm babbling here – there's a way in which formation also kind of – to me, one of the messages is deal with me. This is who I am, and this is who we are, but this is who I am. So deal with me. Look at me right now and acknowledge that I exist and that I'm important.
And that's to the white society, and then – to the black society, it's more like, we're here, go for it. Be out there. Be part of things. Get information. Get information. You know? It's got both those audiences.
I'm curious also, Madison. I mean, when this video came out on Saturday, did people start talking about it right away? I mean, going into the Super Bowl, did young people already know about this video?
Honestly, I actually didn't hear about it till the day after the Super Bowl, because I'd been working and whatnot.
You've been watching the Super Bowl?
No, because my team wasn't playing, you know?
Yeah.
I only stayed to watch the halftime show, really. But I didn't hear about it till afterwards, and me and my mom like to talk about what goes on in the news, and we were just had a long conversation about why the heck they're even backlashing at it, and even if it's even necessary, because it's really not necessary, it's a song. And and she's making money from it.
It's a slow news week, I think. Like, sometimes it's just like there's not, well, what can we pick on this week? This.
Well, because people have lots of time on their hands, there is going to be a protest on Tuesday of next week at the NFL headquarters. And the protesters are being encouraged to wear blue, wear as much blue as possible. Avoid wearing black because the beehive counter-protesters will be all dressed in black attire. I don't know how they know
that. I really hope this results in a dance-off.
I think you'll know that that's the one thing that they're not going to want to do, the people who are protesting this. But anyway.
They're protesting Beyonce being there? Mm-hmm.
Yep. And there's a hashtag boycott Beyonce and a hashtag blue lives matter. And yes, absolutely. But this is – indignation is an industry. I mean, it's an –
Yeah, that's true.
Indignation is an industry, and there are a lot of people who make money off of indignation. Well, we're going to have a quick break. We're going to be going to head into a little bit of a pledge drive here. If you like the show, if you like the conversation you're hearing right now – think about calling that number and making that pledge, even if you don't typically do. And thanks so much to Madison Frey making her debut. I'm sure she'll be back on other occasions, but a high school junior from upstairs at the Journalism and Media Academy helping us out understanding Formation and Beyonce. When we come back from this break, we'll talk about Samantha Bee's new television show. And if time, we'll talk about what Twitter does to our brains when we live tweet or read live tweets while we're supposedly doing something else, like watching the Super Bowl or more likely a presidential debate. Cool to me, you got some coordination.
I'm just worried that by the time I get my own late night show, all the good ideas will be gone. Except spanking Rudy Giuliani. That never gets old. Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kyone Wolf, with help from Jonathan McPants. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and our intern is Benjamin Esty. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jay-Z. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Here and Now staff taking hot sauce out of their bags, go to our website, WNPR.org/Colin. We'll return with a new show on Tuesday. And now, back to the nose.
That's right. We get some special programming on Monday for President's Day. Then we'll be back on Tuesday. All right. So speaking of brand new late night shows, Samantha Bee, often engaging and funny Canadian performer on The Daily Show, has now got her own show called Full Frontal. It's on TBS, always a hard network to find. So let's hear just a little bit of what Sam sounds like all by herself.
But Hillary wanted us to know that she's also just folks.
This is hard for me. I never thought I'd be standing on a stage here asking people to vote for me for president.
Oh. Who, me, president? Oh, golly gumdrops. I don't know if little old me could ever.
Yes! Anoint me your god. What more do you people want from me?
That's Samantha Bee on Full Frontal. So it does seem as though there are so many late-night comedy shows, it's hard to keep up with all of them. So Teresa Kramer, why don't you get it started for us? How did this work for you?
I liked it just fine. It's hard to say. It's a weekly show, so there's only, instead of a nightly show, like most of these, you know, normally we would have had three or four to look at by now, but there's only one, so what can you really tell from that? I think I like it. And I think the real question is, how many of these shows do we need? Is there anything different you can even do with it at this point?
Well, she's trying to do a number of different things that you pointed out, actually, in your initial email about
this. There's no guests, but John Oliver is already doing that. And Colin, I don't even remember what I said earlier. What did I say?
I don't know.
Yeah. She's a woman.
She's a woman. There's no
big difference.
Even,
there's no
so
desk.
She's no desk.
Are there never going to be guests?
I would think there probably aren't, unless.
I read they were going to try it out and see. Yeah. They don't know.
She said if it pertains to what they're talking about, but they're not just going to have someone come on and talk about their movie.
She doesn't
want to.
Yeah, she said, I just can't do that.
Which is the most boring. I mean, I don't know who watches the guests on The Daily Show. I don't know who's doing that, unless it's someone, a presidential candidate or something.
So what we have is Samantha Bee standing out, standing, not sitting, on this strangely Nexium-colored set, and throwing to some clips, using clips kind of the way that we've seen Jon Stewart and others used them in the past. But it is significant that a number of women, especially her, are getting into what used to be the boys' club. And Irene, the opening to the show kind of deals with that, right? It's a whole bunch of journalists at a press conference asking her, like, how do I watch your show as a man? Questions like that.
Right. So just pointing to the silliness of – or the silliness from a certain point of view. But it's true that people think, oh, my gosh, a woman is doing it. How is it going to be different and et cetera? And it is different seeing, a woman doing it. Though I think it's interesting that it's called full frontal. Why is it called full frontal?
I was wondering the same thing.
You know, it's an odd choice. Mm-hmm. And she didn't, I don't think she, that, I wanted one of the journalists to ask that.
Yeah.
Why did you call it that?
Well, a note of the salacious always helps, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess so.
And plus, she's not sitting down. She's standing up facing the audience the whole time, so that's the pun on that, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I guess. But she has her clothes on.
It really beats prefrontal anyway. That's, you know.
I think it's interesting to think about news, like how you consume, you know, how you, in a way, if you hadn't watched the debate and you watched her show, you would have seen, you know, many of the juicy tidbits that they were showing everywhere else. And I think it's an interesting practice that people used to have with Jon Stewart, you know, maybe with Trevor Noah to some extent, maybe not as much. But with her, you know, you sort of feel like that she really covered a lot of issues that people were talking about the debates in her choice of clips.
Well, it does. That's the question that I have, Rand, is how different can you be? I mean, it's not just Trevor Noah or Larry Wilmore or Seth Meyers or the new Stephen Colbert or James Corden or, to even a lesser extent, Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel. It's all of these people in aggregate just taking the same raw materials, throwing them into kind of a hopper and grinding them out as comedy. And as I was watching her show, I was thinking, boy, it's going to be hard not to basically be running the same plays over and over again.
Well, and I'm by no means a connoisseur sufficiently of all those other shows to be able, you know, to say this authoritatively, but there was almost the moment you played when she made fun of Hillary, and then she, that is Samantha Bee, turned aside and sort of did this Jekyll and Hyde thing, and a lurid red light was shining up on her face. That was probably the most inventively strange moment mm-hmm. in it. Otherwise, it was all pretty pro forma. The show is structured like a monologue to a talk show, but then the talk show doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. It's sort of an extended intro to a show that then doesn't happen. But the monologue, it's not really so much a written thing as a montage of clips with sort of perfect one-liners about the clips. So with this kind of thing, you have to make sure that the clips are selected very well, and that they're put together then with like her one or two line comments with sort of perfect timing. I thought that worked well. There were times when I laughed. They did this thing with Bernie Sanders where it showed him making from the debate podium this sort of same gesture when Hillary would make a point and Bernie is signaling to the questioners, oh, I want to make a point about that. And he raises a finger and Samantha Bee says, well, this is Bernie trying to call for the waitress. And it was true.
That was
it looked
really
so
funny.
Much like a yeah. like a guy unsuccessfully trying to get attention in a restaurant, and they did about 10 of them in rapid order. I thought that was hilarious. So I thought it was funny.
He does that at every debate. I didn't realize. You know,
there was nothing new about this, I thought. And I thought about the fact that people are now saying about Hillary, oh, well, I'm voting for Bernie because it doesn't really matter that a woman is going to be president. We sort of jumped over the imperative of having a woman be president without a woman actually being president. And I wonder if there's a sort of similar way in which, you know, that's happening with Samantha Bee. It's like, oh, this is really important, but actually, it's not so important. What's important is how the show works.
Well,
yeah, good point.
I think that she can strengthen the show by having it be more specifically her. So I agree with Rand that moment where she kind of transformed into this, you know, Sumerian goddess out of, you know, or whatever she was chanting, Gozer or something from Ghostbusters as Hillary, was really funny because it even touched back to the intro. If you remember, the intro ends by her saying, we're all witches, and then showing this kind of very freaky, you know, coven kind of scene. So messing with that a little bit, I mean, I thought, like, to me, the most inventive joke was she was talking about the fact that in the Democratic debates, they agree a lot. you know, well, I agree with her, or she agrees with me. And he goes, she goes, such terse agreements. She goes, it kind of reminds me of the 2 months right before my parents admitted they were going to get divorced. And first of all, that's sort of a – I've never heard that particular joke ever made quite that way, and it seemed kind of personal. And to me, I mean, I thought, wow, if you could develop that side a little bit more and less of – I mean, I was actually sort of uncomfortable with the Jeb Bush video. The longest set piece
was – It
went
on too long.
And it's kicking a guy who – I mean, it's almost the kind of bullying that Donald Trump routinely delivers to Jeb Bush. Mm-hmm. Who needs to watch a comedy show bullying Jeb Bush? That's all that's going on in the outside world.
And she wasn't even in it, you know? I mean, because it seems like – now I'm thinking that it should be more like the Dave Chappelle show where he was in those little skits. He would stand up there just like she is, and then that would cut to a skit that she was a part of. And she seems to have that kind of physical humor, kind of drama thing that she could really do some hilarious skits.
I'm going to do my Bernie impression and raise my finger now, because one of the things I was thinking about to really set it apart was to make it more field pieces, because she that's what she did mostly on The Daily Show and what she was really good at. And so why not do a show like that where she's going out and actually talking to people and interviewing people and, you know, and those were often the funniest part of The Daily Show, I thought. So why not just do a whole show of them instead of just having another person talking about the same old clips?
And one of the things those field pieces did very well was exploit discomfort, right? In fact, when with this bullying thing that they did about Jeb Bush, where they were the bully and he was the target, it really reminded me she did this fabulous field piece for the Daily Show where she went and visited a guy who was running an anti-bullying organization. But the key was that he had been a bully. He admitted that he was an older man. He was a reformed bully, and now he wanted to counteract bullying. And she kept saying all this. She kept being a target. She'd say to him, well, it's been nice talking to you, but I have to go see my allergist. And then I have an oboe lesson right after that. And then she'd go, come on. You really want to shove me, don't you? Come on, do it. And there was this tremendous discomfort that built up there. And I thought, that's more interesting.
That takes an interesting brazenness.
You kept waiting for it to go to another level that might be self-referential or self-mocking instead of simply repeating the same tropes that, you know, have been successfully used against him.
Well, because one of the things I thought about that same divorce joke, Colin, was like, that's personal to a writer. Like, that doesn't necessarily, that's not necessarily, Samantha Bee's parents may still be married for all we know, but someone, some like 25-year-old kid in the writer's room might have made that joke.
True. Yeah. All right, we have to switch gears here. We only have about 4 minutes left for our recommendations. So I'll go to you first, Teresa. What have you got?
Oh, geez, so fast. Okay. No, I've got one. So on Netflix, there's a documentary right now called A Genius Leaves the Hood, I believe that's what it's called. It's about Jay-Z and his rise from crack dealer to giant media mogul, and it is fascinating. And I learned quite a bit from it. So get out there and watch it.
Right. So watch the Foundation video a whole bunch, Formation video a whole bunch of times, and then watch this thing. The Foundation video would be the Ayn Rand one. Very different. All right, go ahead.
I just have a lifestyle one. Somebody said to me recently that they always try to say thank you to whenever anyone does something they like, they say thank you. Someone in a store, a friend, anyone. And so I've been trying to do that. Like, thank you for appreciating things that people do. So often we just notice it and don't say anything. So my recommendation is say thank you when anyone does something you like, even if it's a stranger.
How's it working out so far?
Great. People get so happy. They just can't believe it.
Well, thank you for that fine recommendation. That's a very good one. All right.
I have two things. One, an article in the current New York Review of Books by Jacob Weisberg called We Are Hopelessly Hooked, that surveys the extent to which we have become a handheld device society in the last 5 years, and looks at the pros and cons of that. This is a subject dear to me. Second thing, a novel I'd never heard of but I've read in preparation for the Tournament of Books called Oreo by Fran Ross. She was an African-American writer. She died in 1985. She published one only novel in 1974. If you are interested in a lot of the stuff that came up in the Beyoncé conversation, Fran Ross was half African-American, half Jewish. The book is a wildly, strangely Joycean, polyglot, brilliant account of her identity. And I've really never read anything like it. I'd never heard of her before. It's one of those curiosities of American literature, Oreo by Fran Ross.
All right. I have a bunch of recommendations. They all have to do with basketball because football's over, right? Football's over. You need to get interested in basketball. Start out with 99% Invisible, the amazing podcast hosted by Roman Mars, who's like the coolest guy in podcasting. But the new episode, I think it's number 199, is called The Yin and Yang of Basketball. It's about how basketball was created and designed. It goes back to Naismith and then talks about all the changes and the development of the three-point line, the way that Lew Alcindor and then Kareem Abdul-Jabbar challenged basketball to change itself because they thought he was getting too powerful, too big, too important. It's just the whole thing is just amazing. Kind of leads you to the moment that we're at right now, where the NBA, anyway, is getting smaller. The teams are getting a lot smaller. They're playing a lot smaller. Then once you're done with that, then you can watch Kareem, A Minority of One, the new HBO sports documentary. It's terrific, and he's a very interesting guy, much more interesting. I mean, it's beginning to emerge what an interesting guy he is. Anyway. Sure. His writing,
Holmes.
All kinds of stuff like that. His Lakers teammate, James Worthy, calls him a different piece of toast, which is
what does that mean?
Yeah, I know. I like it, though. Yeah. And so connected to that, two more quick things. So Danielle Marshall, of formerly of UConn, currently shears the mark for the most three-pointers in one game, 12 three-pointers in one game. Because the NBA is getting smaller, that will fall pretty soon. That's what he's been saying. He says, right now, we know we've been fortunate to still have it and probably won't much longer. He and Kobe Bryant both hold that. So watch for that to fall. And then one did fall. A big record fell over last weekend. Brandon Sherrod, who was on our basketball show on Thursday, broke the record for the most consecutive field goals in NCAA play. He was heading into the game with, I think, 25. He broke the record with his 27th uninterrupted shot from the floor over a streak of about four games. He wound up with 30. That's the new record for the most shots from the floor made without a miss. So congratulations to Brandon Sherrod. Plays for Yale.
I heard that B.O.B. was going to be in the halftime show, but his boat fell off the edge of the earth. Gravity, am I right?